From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire and it is Thursday, April 23. For the duration of the COVID-19 crisis, Please Explain is coming to you 5 days a week. As of this afternoon, Australia has recorded 6,660 cases of coronavirus. But since yesterday, nationwide, just 7 new cases have been confirmed as we continue to flatten the curve. I'm joined now by Chief Political Correspondent David Crowe. Welcome back to Please Explain, David.
Good to be back on.
I can see that your coronavirus beard has gone.
Yes.
Is that a good sign?
Oh, it's a very good sign. It's a return to normality, which is actually the theme of the moment, isn't it, in terms of the response to the virus. The numbers are better. Everybody's feeling less anxious. A bit of normality on the horizon, hopefully.
Yes, maybe a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. I wanted to talk to you today about, you and I both just watched the Prime Minister and the Treasurer give a press conference, mostly about the economic response. The Prime Minister said he would update with the Chief Medical Officer tomorrow. In the first 3 days since the JobKeeper program has become available, 275,000 Australian companies have registered for that system, where they get a $1,500 a fortnight subsidy if they keep staff on the books. And also the Treasurer said that 587,000 applications for the Job Seeker program have been processed. That's extraordinary numbers so quickly, isn't it, David?
It is. And it's interesting that they're now acknowledging, I guess, some of the pressure on the system with some of these applications, especially with the JobKeeper payment, which is the $1,500 payment per fortnight for people who still have a job or at least still have an employer who can handle that payment. For those people, we've got a pressure point. We've got employers who need that JobKeeper money paid to their staff, but of course they've got to wait until at least the end of the month for the tax system to make those payments possible. So the message from the government is, if you're an employer who needs that support, go to your bank and ask them for some bridging finance just to get you through the next couple of weeks so you can pay the staff, knowing that that wages bill will be covered by the JobKeeper allowance when it kicks in through the tax system.
What are people saying to you, David, about the length of these programs? A couple of weeks ago, when we were still at a much higher point on the curve of new cases, there was a lot of concern that 6 months was not going to be enough for JobKeeper and was not going to be enough for JobSeeker. Has that idea changed now that we're down into single digit new cases in some states and some states not even having new cases at all?
I think there's a much greater level of confidence now about the removal of some of the restrictions and therefore the ability for the economy to ease back. Now, I don't think that that helps enough with the job seeker allowance, because that's for people who are unemployed. Every previous economic shock, the GFC, for instance, has shown that it takes a long time to get the unemployment rate back down. And I don't think that's going to happen within 6 months. That could be a year, 2 years. It's a long process. I think the real positive sign here is that if economic restrictions can be eased back, then there's hope that the JobKeeper allowance can be phased out in the government's timetable. The government is still saying that it's about a six-month program. So I don't think that there's any willingness on the government part to keep that $1,500 payment per fortnight going after the six-month period that began on March 1. So they've got a problem there. If there are still a lot of companies struggling by the time we get to August, then there'll be demands on the government to keep the program going. But $130 billion over 6 months is a lot of money, and I think the government is just not contemplating at the moment keeping that going because it's so expensive.
Perhaps this is a result of us all getting to the point where we can catch our breath after six weeks of being in full crisis mode. But there is now a lot of commentary and pressure on the federal government to start talking about major economic reforms coming out the other side of this crisis. It might be too early in the process for them to start doing this, David, but what's their attitude to how much things are going to change economically, legally, fiscally, as we come out the end of 2020?
It's interesting that they're sending signals about the willingness to debate some really big ideas. And this is all centred around the October budget. the budget should be next month. It should be a couple of weeks away, but it's been delayed until October, which gives the government time to think about what kind of economy we're all going to be working in after this crisis passes. We'll still be dealing with the virus crisis when the October budget comes out. But it's interesting that Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg talk about it as if it's going to have some big markers about economic change. Now, I can't see yet exactly what kind of reforms they're looking at, but we see a lot of ideas around. We see ideas about how we've got to focus on domestic manufacturing because we've suddenly realised we're in a different world now where those supply chains and that reliance on overseas suppliers can be a weakness. Now, is that really going to translate into hard policy? We can't be sure yet, but the October budget is the moment when we might see some signs. On things like tax reform, the message from the government, from Scott Morrison explicitly on Thursday, was about growing the economy, not adjusting negative gearing, not about changing tax rates on dividends and going back to that debate from before the last election. It's about a bigger picture. Sorry to use the Malcolm Turnbull book title there, but it's about the big picture of tax reform and growing the economy, encouraging investment. Now, they're not specific about what they mean, but they are setting up this debate before the October budget. They want ideas. They're not ruling anything out. They're not ruling anything in specifically. I don't know how long they're going to be able to sort of let the 1,000 ideas bloom, because that's a very difficult thing for politicians to do. And sooner or later, we see pressure on them to rule things out, like ruling out an increase in the GST. They want the debate, and that's an encouraging sign. But I think we're now in the phase where everybody can put forward an idea on an equal footing as long as they put it forward in good faith.
It would be amazing, wouldn't it, given we've had a good decade of stagnation in taxation reform in this country or more, that if this crisis is actually the catalyst that allows finally some structural reform.
And I'm a bit sceptical about whether it will be. I'm sceptical about the argument that the world has changed forever, that the old rules no longer apply. We're now in a new world where there'll be a new approach. I think there are a lot of people who would like to think that's the case, that we can say goodbye to that rancorous, hyper-partisan politics of the last decade. But I'm not so sure that it's gone. I think that once the crisis passes, some of the old attitudes will re-emerge. I don't think it's going to be easy if the government decides that maybe a company tax cut is the way forward to encourage investment. I think that that would get bogged down in the parliament, just like it did in the past. So there's a long way to go, and I don't think the government's that naive that it thinks that just because it has 6 months of debate that therefore there's going to be some kind of consensus in parliament. It's going to be extremely difficult, this debate.
We can have very short memories once we come out the other side of a crisis, can't we?
Yeah.
It would be remiss of me while I've got you on the podcast not to do a massive gear change and ask you about Malcolm Turnbull and the release of his memoir. You wrote an extraordinary piece for Good Weekend last Saturday about where Malcolm is now as far as his, I guess, recovery from the end of his political career. It got a huge reaction. What do you think about the timing for him of releasing a book where he's been very critical of almost everyone in Australian public life in the middle of this crisis?
I think the timing was bad, just really bad. Bad for everybody, really. Bad for the publisher, the booksellers, bad for Malcolm Turnbull personally. Not good for the government because it had this sort of argument about its own side of politics when it's trying to deal with a national crisis. Some of that was unavoidable, really, because the book couldn't be delayed. It was on its way to the printers when the coronavirus crisis really struck hard with a vengeance. So it was what it was. I don't think it's... look, it's a great book. For a political journalist like me, it's a great read. I really enjoyed it. So I'm not going to say it was a bad book to write. I think it's got costs, though. I think it's got costs in terms of the breach between Malcolm Turnbull and the government he once led. He's not somebody now that Scott Morrison can go to in the way that we've seen with former prime ministers in the past to say, oh, look, here's a national commission to counter the coronavirus. Could I turn to you to lead it or to help in some way? And I think These are the prices people pay when you have these fundamental breaches in politics.
Can I just ask, David, would Malcolm Turnbull have been that kind of person before the book came out?
No, I think we've got to the point where the breaches are so fundamental, there's no way back. And the bitterness is so deep, not so much with Scott Morrison, but certainly you see that bitterness between Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Abbott. That relationship will never be repaired. That gulf will never be bridged. It's there forever. The bitterness is so great. But we have seen in the past, Scott Morrison was willing to give Malcolm Turnbull a role. He asked Malcolm Turnbull at the end of 2018, to help with the relationship with Indonesia on foreign policy. And Malcolm Turnbull stepped in. It wasn't a very good exercise because Turnbull has such strong opinions. He's a big figure, and therefore he expressed his opinion quite freely to the cost of Scott Morrison on how that relationship was going. In another world with different personalities, you'd like to think that a former Prime Minister can be recruited to that kind of task, but that's not the world we live in now.
So just to add to the friction between the former Prime Minister and the current Prime Minister, can you tell us just briefly what happened when it came to the alleged distribution of Malcolm Turnbull's book by someone in the Prime Minister's office?
I find this fascinating story, and I know readers have found it fascinating as well, because it's an insight into the way the advisor class and sometimes the political class, the MPs themselves, behave. Now, we've got a government that's meant to be in charge of copyright law. Inside that government, we've got advisors flouting copyright flagrantly by emailing around a pirated version of Malcolm Turnbull's book. And this is a really interesting insight into politics today. The level of hatred or dislike of Turnbull is so great that you've got people eagerly trying to suppress sales for his book by spreading the pirated ebook around. And that includes top advisors to Scott Morrison, it includes MPs, it includes officials high in the Liberal Party. And so there are consequences here, because once the publisher found out about this, because all these people talk to each other, they're a very chatty group. The word got back to Turnbull and his publisher, and they went legal. They got their lawyer onto it last Saturday night within hours of spotting these copies being shared around, and they identified a fellow called Nico Lowe in the Prime Minister's office, and they went after him. Now, he's apologised for it. There's a settlement that's been reached, but that's just the beginning, because everybody who was forwarded a copy of the pirated ebook is now in the sights of the lawyers. They can go after them and ask them, who did you send it to? And then go through the network from there. So there's still a fair way to go with that legal action. And I know from talking to publishers and booksellers, they want something done about it, because they're really hit hard by the coronavirus crisis. And they don't want to see books being pirated, because this is their livelihood at stake.
Well, it's certainly been a fascinating little distraction from the kind of relentless horror of the economic downturn relating to coronavirus. Listeners, if you haven't yet read David's Good Weekend piece from last Saturday, I commend it to you. It's a really interesting look inside sort of a fascinating character and the end of his career. David, thanks for joining me again. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, Tori. Thanks.
Today's episode of Please Explain was produced by David Escort and Amelia Maguire. The journalists, editors, photographers, producers and tech team at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald are working tirelessly at the moment to cover the COVID-19 crisis factually, fairly and comprehensively. For coverage you can trust, visit our websites or buy our papers. To support our journalism, you can subscribe via our homepages or just search Subscribe, The Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.